Good afternoon. You're listening to Heartbeat Radio for women and the men who love them. I'm Michelle Wargo, and it's now time for Growing Champions for Life with David Benzel. David, how you doing?
I'm fine, Michelle. It's always good to be back here with you.
It's always exciting. You always have the most interesting tidbits of information.
We have good topics, don't we?
We do. I liked last week we had a conversation about conversations.
Yes, that's right. We talked about the art of having good constructive conversations with your children and how to keep those healthy. And today we're going to be speaking with a guest. We, you know, sometimes we have fascinating guests, mm-hmm. and today is one of those days. This is actually a gentleman that I met years ago. I don't even remember how many years ago, but we were both living in Central Florida. Now he is in South Florida. His name is Dr. Rick Jensen, and he is a sports psychologist.
Oh, fantastic.
And I was particularly interested in kind of teaming up with Rick for a while because of some symposiums that we were doing out at the Olympic Training Center for water ski coaches. Mm-hmm. And so Rick and I got involved and kind of shared, you know, a little brain trust there a little bit. And I was just fascinated with his formal education in this area of sports psychology. Today, now he's a 20-year veteran as a sports psychologist working with professional golfers on the professional golf tour.
Oh, wow.
And also professional tennis players on that tour.
Busy.
So, yeah. So, but he's just got just great insights into that mental aspect of sport. And I thought that in speaking with Rick today, we could share some things with our listeners about how parents interact with their kids and how it affects the psychology of their experience. Because, you know, it's a complicated thing. It's physical, it's emotional.
There's a lot going on.
And we all know it's mental as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's welcome him.
Hey, Rick, are you there?
I'm here. Welcome.
He just welcomed us into his office, I think.
Thank you.
Do I lay down on the couch?
Exactly.
Is that what comes next?
That's right. Have a seat.
Well, Rick, you have two children of your own now, I understand, a boy and a girl.
I do. I have a 13-year-old boy. I'm sorry, a 13-year-old girl and a 10-year-old boy.
And they both play soccer, don't they?
They have played soccer. They kind of jump from, they played a number of sports. My daughter's more involved in dance now. I used to coach their soccer team when they were younger. My son does hip hop. My daughter does dance. They both do volleyball.
Wow.
They're kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
Just trying different things out.
What kind of coach were you?
What kind of a coach?
Yeah. Were you a bully coach?
I was the type of coach where I didn't worry about winning. I just wanted them to have a great experience. And I couldn't even tell you how many times we won. It didn't matter. It was more about letting the kids enjoy learning soccer. And we gave them a lot of power to pick different positions. If they wanted to play goalie, we'd let them play goalie, whether balls rolled by them or not. It was a good time.
Yeah. And did you feel pressured by others to be more concerned about winning?
I think initially I did because I was concerned that I'd have parents that were around that was what their concern was. But we spent a lot of time. I co-coached the team with my wife. And so my wife and I both coached it. And we spent a lot of time with the parents, just talking to the parents about our philosophy and that it wasn't about winning, and if they needed it to be, then they could take their kid and put them on a different team.
Yeah.
So right from the front, we kind of established why we were coaching and what we were looking to do with the kids.
Yeah, that's really what it seems to me now as I have worked more with teams and with coaches, how important it is to set the tone at the very, very beginning of the season about what the culture of this team is going to be. Because if you don't do that, there's all kinds of assumptions that are incorrect. There are priorities that don't line up with maybe the coach's priorities, and the beginning is the time to create your culture by design rather than let something show up by default.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that you use the word culture too. I think I think of it just through that same lens, is that you're trying to build a culture on the team that the one in which the kids are supporting one another, that the parents are more just being there, kind of applauding their children and embracing that they're involved in sports as opposed to winning. I guess something that was very intriguing to me was how different the culture could be within the same league from one team to the next. I mean, we'd be kind of not worried so much about winning. I mean, certainly trying to teach the kids the skills to where if they were good enough, they would win. So I had teams where we would win a lot of games, but frankly, it was just because we had great athletes on our team. They could take the ball all the way down and score on their own. It didn't really have much to do with our coaching as much as who happened to be on our team. But then you'd look across the field on the other side and see a parent coaching another team that just was going crazy on kids and just really letting them have it, almost like they were teaching the NFL, you know, coaching in the NFL.
Yeah, there was a big contract on the line there, wasn't there? Yeah. Now, I want to, I guess I asked those questions because I wanted to establish not only you have credibility as a sports psychologist, but I wanted to establish your credibility as someone who's been involved in youth sports, which you obviously have. But now from the position of a sports psychologist, as you work with athletes, I want to talk a little bit about this topic of fear and how big of an issue do you find that fear is for athletes in terms of their performance and what affects their performance. How much time do you spend talking about or handling fear?
When you say fear, you're referring more to fear of failure or fear of injury?
Well, actually, I think all fears inhibit performance. And certainly fear of injury can even do it. Fear of failure can. Fear of your parents after the game can. I mean, I think fear is fear. But tell me, how much do you find... Now, I know when you're dealing with adult athletes, now the parent thing isn't maybe quite so important, but do you find yourself coaching up people to handle these kinds of inhibiting fears?
You do. You know, sometimes I see it probably more through the lens, certainly with kids. It's a fear of failure, or you might even look at it more from... In psychology, we'll call it public expectations. So public being parental expectations more often than not. That's where the kids learn it. But then you see it later when they get into, whether it be high school or college or beyond, it's this expectation of I'm not performing up to someone else's expectations, which over time becomes their own. In other words, they don't have the freedom to understand that one day you might play well, another day you might not play well. The day they're not playing well, they're looking over their shoulder and looking to see that dad's got a grimace on his face or turned around or not paying attention or is upset. And I think fear actually comes from this sense of my public expectation of success is X, and I'm not achieving that. And kids are very sensitive to, you know, what their parents are doing. I do a lot of work in golf, and you tend to stay outside the ropes in golf and walk through the trees and down this, you know, down the rough. And while the kids play in the middle, and so I'm typically walking among parents. And it is amazing the comments that will come out of parents' mouth about their own kids and how they will almost demonstratively express their disgust.
That's horrible.
So that their kids can see it. I've always said it, with children, 98% of the children that have mental issues in sport, whether it be fear or anxiety or lack of confidence, is tied to their relationships with their parents. It doesn't have to do with the kid having a mental disorder or mental issues. It has very much to do with their expectations that have been placed upon them through their parents.
Yeah.
So
and,
how do you deal with that?
We'll answer that question. Yeah, how do you deal with that?
Now I work more with pros, so in tennis you end up having to deal with that because in tennis there's still some kids that play, but in golf they tend to be past that. They've separated from their parents, and it's sad to see. But when I work more with juniors, I would say to the parents, you're my client, not your kid. I would always just say the real issue, your kid's behavior is tied to your parenting would be my rule. And unless the kid truly had an emotional disorder, they had an emotional handicap, they had, but that was not the case, again, 98% of the time. I would say to the parent, if you want your kid to work with me, you have to work with me too.
Ah, so you made it very clear that they're part of the formula here.
No question about it.
Yeah, that sounds good because that's why we created our workshops in Growing Champions for Life. We created our workshops for the parents. And I've had the parents come up to me after my workshop and say, will you please do a workshop for the kids? Will you sit down and tell the kids all these cool things you're telling them? And my answer usually is, you know, I don't mind talking to kids. I think that's fun. But you have access to your child 365 days of the year. And so the messages that are getting sent to them are coming from you around the dinner table, in the car on the way there, in the car on the way afterwards. And those messages need to be the right kind of messages, or it doesn't matter what I tell them in one 1-hour workshop.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's tremendous, Dave, what we talked before about what you're doing, and it's so needed, both from, I think the kids can learn things, but what you don't want is the kids learning something and then them going, well, why are my own parents not behaving that way?
Yeah.
Why are my own parents not responding to me the way you as a professional are responding to me? It would be sad to create that dichotomy. I'd want there to be more consistency so that if I'm going to be interacting with a child around performance one way, I'd like there to be some consistency from the dad or the mom doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So otherwise the kid could become very even more disappointed in their relationship with their parent because maybe they want their parent to act more like me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a good thing either.
No, that's right. And so the distance, gets created between children and their parents over really a loss of credibility. As the parents drop in credibility in their child's eyes, now suddenly, the relationship starts to deteriorate.
Isn't it the truth?
Yeah. This is Dr. Rick Jensen, by the way, folks, if you're just tuning in. He's a sports psychologist, lives down in South Florida, and someone that I've known for many years. And we're talking about how, from a psychological as well as an emotional position, athletes have to deal with things like fear and how a sports psychologist ends up coaching up parents in order to deal with this. What about, similarly, the topic of thinking, or I often call it overthinking, and I sometimes feel guilty that I maybe made my son too much of a thinker, because I was such an analytical athlete myself, and I analyzed, my performances and all that, and sometimes I think the best athletes don't think so much, they just do.
I would agree with you. I think, what they see, much of the research would support more around the analytical side of sport is actually a wonderful skill for coaches to have, but less so. And Dave, so you ended up coaching in skiing.
Yes.
So the fact that you were maybe analytical in your own athletic endeavors could have had some limitations on your performance, but then that would have been a strength moving into coaching, because coaching involves analytics and diagnostics and picking out kind of critical aspects of them, of whether it's a technical move or a performance issue. So, but you're right. I think with most players, the art, I think, of great coaching or great parenting, because many coaches are parents. When many of us coach our kids,
mm-hmm.
when our kids are young, is what not to say. I've always said the better coaches spend more of their energy on what not to say as opposed to what to say. But parents oftentimes are not trained in that. They're not trained coaches. They played sports when they were young or even when they're older. I work a lot in golf, and golf is an overthinking sport as much as anything, because you're just standing over the ball. But parents will just kind of watch the Golf Channel one night and the next day just deliver all that information onto their kids with no filter at all. And it does transfer right to the kids, because then the kids are out and you see them standing over the ball trying to hit a ball, and they're almost locked in space because mm-hmm. they're trying to go through their 10-point checklist of all the things that their dad told them they have to do well in order to hit a ball well.
Well, and golf's the sport where most of the time you see the mental reaction to a bad swing. People throw their clubs. People get really angry at themselves when they don't perform well.
We give our clubs flying lessons,
yes,
is
exactly
what I used to say. Well, and I heard a great a baseball player, or actually a baseball coach, ask a very good baseball player. He said, "What do you think about when hitting's not going well?" And he says, "Oh, I'm thinking about everything." And he says, "What are you thinking about when hitting's going well?" He says, "I'm not thinking about anything."
Mm-hmm.
And that really hit home with me, is that that's what it's like. When kids play what I'll call al natural, mm-hmm. just right from their soul, that's when they play their best. And that's usually when they're really young, before they start to get concerned about the good opinion of others.
I think you're right.
And I liken that to, who are the first people on the dance floor at a wedding other than the bride and groom? The kids and the drunks. And they have something in common. They don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care. They're
uninhibited. And that's why they're out there having fun and doing their thing. Mm-hmm. And athletes have to play from that same place.
I used to go to the Junior World Championship. It would be the top events in golf. And there'd be 10, 11-year-old kids shooting par golf on tough golf courses. And I would do training with them. And I would ask these 10-year-olds, hey, when you're out there, what are you thinking when you're hitting that ball? And they would just simply go, I'm trying to hit it over there by that bunker.
That's
and
it.
And on the way into the green, you say, so what you think over that ball? And they say, I was trying to hit it by the hole. They have no sense at all, really, about what their body is doing in space, which adults kind of get to. There's some of that training that needs to be given in terms of providing that. But, again, that's why you want your kids with, I've always said to parents, you know, get your kids to a trained coach, you know, as soon as possible, and then you can be a parent. Be the parent, be the sponsor, fund their training, but get them with someone who knows how to train kids. Mm-hmm. It is very different, but it's one of the best things you can. I mean, my kids are in sports now, and we did it when they were younger, but now as they've gotten better, we don't coach them anymore. There's people much better than I am at coaching that I put my kids in front of.
If there's something that parents could do to avoid this overthinking deal, you've mentioned, you know, focus on what not to say. If we're talking to parents, because they do go out and play with their kids, they go out and, you know, hit around a golf, or they go to the tennis court and hit the tennis ball back and forth across the net, they play catch with their sons, they shoot basketballs with their daughters, what can we say to parents to avoid this trap of creating an overthinking athlete?
I think much of the overthinking is, again, getting into the analytical issues of cause and effect. So rather than having a cause and effect discussion, which is, you know, as soon as your child comes off the tennis court or comes off the basketball court, instead of saying, why do you think you missed those free throws? Or, you know, what do you think was wrong? Why do you think you kept pulling all of your shots to the left? They tend to have a cause and effect mindset as opposed to what I would call self-discovery. If they would ask questions that are more self-discovery of their kids, like, what did you learn today? You know, how did you think you played? What holes were best? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, instead of always going to the negative and trying to find a cause of that negative effect, go to the positive and then ask questions that are more around self-discovery. Don't tee them up to show them how much you know about the fact why they were hooking the golf ball or double faulting. Mm-hmm. Go more to, hey, that was great. You won that. You know, that second set, you were really aggressive, playing really well. You look so confident. How come? What did you do out there? And let the kid kind of go into their memory bank of when they were doing something well, as opposed to always trying to figure out and explain why they were playing poorly.
Wow, that is a great, you know, that's the Socratic method of learning, right? We go back to Socrates and we say, learn to ask really good questions.
Exactly,
and,
right.
And through that process, not only does the athlete discover the answer, but we actually get a thinking athlete in the right sense. They start to think about what works and what doesn't work, but without waiting for the brain dump from mom or dad.
That's right. Yeah, and I've always said the training I want to provide to mom and dad, I wrote a book in golf recently, and in one of the chapters, I spent an entire chapter talking about, I think the title of the chapter, I said that you will only play better than average 50% of the time. That's a statistical fact, is that anybody will play. That's the definition of average. So if you take your child or your own performance and your child's average skill, which as a child, a 10, 12-year-old, they're not a professional tennis player, golfer, basketball, whatever they play. Mm-hmm. They're a 10-year-old playing. Well, even that 10-year-old is going to play above average only 50% of the time. The flip side of that is obviously they're playing below average 50% of the time, statistical fact. So why would we be, every time they play below average, why are we acting like it's an anomaly?
Yeah.
Why are we acting like they did something wrong and something was broken? It's not broken. It's normal. It's why they call it a normal bell curve.
Wow.
So, and you're talking about when you say average, you mean that child's average.
That child's average.
Right.
So if that child's even if that child is one of the best players in that city, that child's average will, again, be better than other children there. But you have to look at your child and look at them and go, not their best days. Parents tend to lock in on, I know your potential because I've seen it.
Yeah.
Well, a potential happens 5% of the time. 95% of the time, they shouldn't even play to that. We really need to look at our kids more realistically as to what's their average play. And then even when we know that, which most parents don't even accept that level of play, they're going to play below that 50%
of the
time.
Wow.
And we have to parent effectively on that 50% of the time.
Yeah. And, you know, I believe in baseball, at least from a hitting standpoint, it's less than that. Mm-hmm. You know, baseball is that sport where, you know, you get 3 hits out of 10 and you go to the Hall of Fame.
Right.
And it's just a terrible
sport.
That's
a good example, Dave. Think about that. So if someone bats 300, they're a phenomenal baseball player. Mm-hmm. But that means there's times when they're batting 100,
yep.
You know, and there's times they're 500. So they're batting somewhere between 100 and, you know, 10% and 50% with 30. If they're batting 300 and that's their average, mm-hmm. well, the 1 or 2 days they bat 100, when they come up, that's expected. Because if there's days when they've kind of went 2 for 4,
right.
that's expected too. But as soon as the day the guy goes 0 for 4, all of a sudden, all kinds of questions are flying about what went wrong that day.
Yeah.
Well, nothing went wrong. That's the other side of the bell curve. It's very normal. Now, if it's happening every day for 3 months, something's wrong.
Yes, right. That's right.
But not the normal fluctuations that we see from one event to another.
And we overreact. My son had a game this past summer where, you know, he went 5 for 5. And his head coach was not there at the game. Davey Johnson, by the way, if you remember him, he's a, you know, he used to coach the Mets, and mm-hmm. he's a MVP, or, yeah, most valuable player and Hall of Famer and all this stuff. Well, he heard that Tata went 5 for 5 one game, and then the next game he called and said, how did he go the second day? Well, he went 0 for 5, you know, so, or 1 for 5 or something. And I think Davey Johnson expected that, you
yeah.
know, he said, oh, he went 5 for 5. Well, how did he do the second game? Because that's, you know, everything has to average out.
Right.
Right. Exactly. It's got to, again, if your average is to go, you know, 1 for 4, there's going to be many days you're going 0 for 4, isn't there? If
yeah,
your
yeah,
average
yeah.
is 1 for 4.
Of course.
And we really can't assume that person's broken.
Yeah, we just don't think about that, though. You know, you see that they're not performing, and you react.
Yeah, on one day.
Yeah.
And on one day.
I always teach parents, I say, sports is like the stock market. As long as the market's going up over time, mm-hmm. your kid is doing just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So don't react day to day. Don't turn on the CNBC and see that it's down today and all of a sudden create a crisis like television does with the stock market every day.
Mm-hmm.
Be a more reasonable investor in your child and treat your child like a good stock that you've bought and hold with time. And then as long as they're improving with time, then reinforce that. Don't get caught up in the market shifts that you see day to day and now create a crisis on the day that it happened to go down.
Yeah, boy, that is great advice. I often hear from parents, Rick, that they feel an obligation to motivate their kids when they don't think their kids are working hard enough. This is very common in my world, that this whole discussion, well, I don't think my kid's working hard enough. He doesn't want it hard enough. You know, how can I motivate my child? And, I mean, I know what I respond to that, because I have some real strong feelings about the error and that kind of thinking. But how do you talk to parents about this whole question of motivation, and can you really motivate your kids?
There's ways to motivate kids using extrinsic motivators, but it's certainly not it's not a very powerful or long standing form of, by extrinsic, I mean you can provide either praise or reward or even punishment or so when parents use things like, whether it's praise on a good day or you got to get out there with, you know, whether it's guilt,
yeah, harassment,
there's all these yeah. things that a parent will impose on a child to try to motivate. Those aren't long-standing. They're not shown to be very productive sources of motivate. They will motivate, because a child to not be critiqued by their
right.
parent will change their behavior. It's just not going to be long-standing. And the negative consequences in terms of relationship between the child and the parent are awful. So really what you're looking for is intrinsic motivators, which means that the child has an intrinsic interest in doing the activity. So what I've always supported with children is, with children, what we're doing as parents is trying to find their passion, trying to find their love for an endeavor. And that may be sports, but just because a dad played baseball doesn't mean that the kid's going to be a great baseball star or has to play baseball.
Or that he even loves it. You know, there's no transfer of love for something just because a parent loved it.
My son, I was an athlete my entire life. My son is nothing like me. Nothing like me. I played all the major sports, basketball, baseball, soccer, football. I played all those sports. My son's nothing like me. He doesn't like those sports. He doesn't enjoy them. If I pushed him to like them, our relationship would not be good because it's not what he enjoys. He likes hip-hop. I never did hip-hop in my life. Mm-hmm. He does hip-hop. I mean, most dads would probably go, why is my son going to a dance studio doing hip-hop? Well, guess what? He picked it. He picked it. He's interested in it. For whatever reason, it's what he wants to do.
There's nothing wrong with that.
It's nothing. My daughter's a dancer, and again, I'm not a dancer. My wife wasn't a dancer, and she's a dancer and plays guitar. So she doesn't yet. She's played soccer. She's played flag football. She's played volleyball. Because I wanted her to test all those things. But then afterwards, the question is, so what do you think? Is that something you liked, or would you want to try something else? Mm-hmm. And my kids, again, throughout their life, have said, no, I think as parents, you want to say, hey, I want you to be physically active. Mm-hmm. I want you to be out. I don't want you to be sitting in front of the television all day or playing computer games. But you have some power to choose, and we'll support your choice, and we'll give you choice. You know, and again, that's certainly parents have to determine what they can afford to place their children in. But what the idea is, the research behind it is, you're looking for what they have an intrinsic desire to do.
Yeah, in other words, something
passion will motivate them
deep within them. Mm-hmm. And this is a great place, because we got only about 4 minutes left here, Rick. But I'd like you to share the story about the athlete that you told me about a week ago when we spoke, whose father wanted him to play tennis to such extreme that he didn't even want him to go to college. Can you give us that brief story, because that is so powerful?
Yeah, the short version of it is I was hired by this family to work with this tennis player. He was 14. The dad would sit outside the court just screaming and yelling at the child. And you could just tell the boy wasn't enjoying tennis. He was an average tennis player, not at all a top player. So he was being extrinsically motivated to do it, and his dad would critique him mercifully. One day I was watching 2020, I think it was 2020 or 60 Minutes, and they did a show on parents who just are overly obsessed with their kids' performance and behaving poorly was the show. And this dad was highlighted on the show. I called him the next day and said, hey, I saw you on this TV show. And the show was really painting him in a bad light. And he says to me on the phone, wasn't that great? Wasn't that a great show? He didn't even see it.
He didn't get it.
Through the lens of the way the show was published. And I said, well, I thought they were kind of painting you in a negative light. And he goes, yeah, they always put that kind of spin on it. He goes, but kids need that kind of motivation. The other side of that is kids need to be pushed. Just what you were saying, David, about that. Fast forward, I ended up not working with the child because the dad wouldn't change. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, I can't do it. If you're not going to be different, I just can't do it. I'd say 4 years later, I get a call from the dad. He says, will you work with my son again? And I said, well, what's your son had to be 17, 18 at the time. And I said, well, what's he doing? Where's he going to college? He goes, he's not going to college. He's turning pro.
What?
And I work with elite tennis players. I'm like, I haven't even seen your son at any of these tournaments. He's not ranked. And he goes, yeah, he's not ranked. He goes, he's not at all. And I said, then why would he turn pro? He said, because college, how's college going to ever help him be a good tennis player? If I have him turn pro, he can play every day and keep working. He obviously isn't working enough. And then you fast forward to that, basically the son. I met with the son one time, and the son says to me privately, says, I need to find a way to get away from my dad. I want to go to college. I love computers. I'm great at computers. I'm brilliant at it. My dad won't let me do it. Will you help me learn how to break away from my dad and fund my own college? And that's what the kid did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
very sad.
Very sad. Because there again, what's been lost is the value of the relationship. The relationship is more important than tennis. It lasts a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm certainly impressed that the child went off and figured out that he had to find his own way to do and pursue his own passion, which is what we all have to do that. Wow, this has been so good, Rick.
Thank you for having me.
I have learned a bunch. It's just helped reframe some of my own philosophy about how to help parents help their kids. And you've got some great analogies and metaphors. I really love the whole thing about kids are going to play, you know, above average 50% of the time and below average 50% of the time.
That really puts it in perspective.
That's a fact, yeah. I love that. Well, we need to get together with you more often, Rick. I might have you back on the show again. But
how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, anything we can promote for you, or how can we have people if they want to get in touch with you?
Again, I allocate my time to professional athletes, so your audience is going to be children. So, not to promote you, Dave, but I would be directing people right back to you, people who have junior players that are looking in this realm, because I work with professional athletes. But if I did, I mean, my website is www.drrickjensen.com. If there are listeners who play golf, the golf book that I wrote would apply to juniors and certainly to parents trying to get a better grasp on why golf's a tough sport, what you really have to do to get better at that sport, and they can go on that website and it talks about that 50% rule.
Oh, awesome.
And kind of just putting things into perspective. And it's written for golf. I think people that read it in any sport could certainly apply the principles outside of that to other sports. But I think that would be something that would be of value to your listeners.
Perfect. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
All right. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Heartbeat Radio for Women.